Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Regional Access. Regional Access is a regional distributor committed to creating sustainable economies throughout the Northeast. For more information, visit regionalaccess.net.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this frigid January morning. Yeah, we've been having some pretty cold weather here in the Northeast. But still, we open the refrigerator every day, at least twice a day. And come on, you know you've done it. You open the refrigerator, you stare at the contents. What's there to eat? Or what should I make for dinner? Well, wasn't always that way because we didn't always have a refrigerator we could open. And today, my guest is here to tell us all about when that changed and how and why. He is Jonathan Reese, who is professor of history at Colorado State University, Pueblo. And Jonathan has published a new book called Refrigeration Nation. Fascinating book. Welcome, Jonathan.
Oh, welcome, Linda.
Jonathan, I have to say, I love how you open. Oh, it started the book with a quote from Francis Bacon in 1624. And if anyone has read him, you know that his writing is always in this wonderful verse. And it just sort of set the tone for everything. And I'm going to read it right now. The producing of cold is a thing very worthy the Inquisition. For heat and cold are nature's two hands by which we chiefly worketh. And heat we have in readiness. But for cold, we must stay till it cometh. The Iceman cometh. Well, that's another whole other story.
That's another pun that comes up later in the
right.
Book. Yeah.
Okay. And there are all kinds of fascinating, wonderful things that we could say, and you did say. But it is true. I mean, we have become so dependent on our refrigerators, and nothing brings that more to mind than when there's a disaster, a power outage. And in fact, you wrote a wonderful article in The Atlantic about the effects of Katrina and the power outages and all the refrigerators, discarded refrigerators. That was more on why our refrigerators are so big. But
yeah,
tell me why refrigeration? What inspired you to write about refrigeration?
Well, I can tell you that my dissertation was on the steel industry, and when I was working at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I used to hang out on the fourth floor of the engineering library, where they had all of these old trade journals about the steel industry. And when you came up out of the elevator, right about eye shot, there was a journal called Ice and Refrigeration. And I started thumbing through that one day when I was bored. And the steel industry is something that historians have really touched on a lot over the last few decades. But nobody had touched the ice and refrigeration industries. And I started reading the journal, and I was completely hooked. It was this lost world that nobody had ever heard about, where they were creating these really elaborate machines in order to create cold. And that technology is similar to what we have today, but it's so much better now. And I wanted to try to do a book to recreate that lost world and sort of explain the change over time from just harvesting ice on New England lakes in the early 19th century to having ice on demand in our homes like
right.
We have now.
Of course, the ice industry was that is a wonderful story too. And
yeah.
You know, before we had our refrigerators, you know, I read an amazing statistic, and that is that 70% of all of America's food is refrigerated at some point between farm and table. And of course, that's more than just our refrigerators, but we'll get into that in a little while.
Yeah.
But there have been methods of preservation, early preservation, prior to refrigeration, and a lot of it, as you say, was ice.
Right.
People dug holes in the ground, and there was the ice industry. But tell us a little bit about those earlier methods before we got to these machines.
There's salting, there's drying, there's potting. There's all sorts of very primitive methods. This pickling, for instance, many of which we still use today for purposes of taste. I think what you mean is, what do you do in order to keep something cold without mm-hmm. mechanical refrigeration?
Right.
And you use an ice box. And we use the term ice box and refrigerator interchangeably, but the original ice box is nothing but a box with ice in it. And then the ice keeps the whatever food you want to keep cold, cold. And the iceman would show up at your door every day or maybe every other day and give you a new block of ice.
Mm-hmm. Anyone who goes to antique shows or maybe has somebody who's a collector, you've seen these ice boxes. And many of them, the American, early American oak ones, were quite beautiful, too.
Gorgeous, yeah. Gorgeous stuff.
But even those who were of a poorer economic means could have a box with a chunk of ice in it. So it wasn't really a class separation thing.
There are people in the poor neighborhoods of New York City who would get ice from the Iceman, wrap it in a blanket, and keep it in their bathtub so that they can have cold drinks. Yeah, ice is something that all classes were interested in, even if all classes weren't able to afford it.
All right. On the ice industry, I mean, that was more than just... the Iceman coming from the Great Lakes here. I mean, that grew to be an international business for some people, right?
Absolutely. There's really two kinds of... Actually, there's one kind of ice that's harvested in the 19th century, but it's put to two different uses. One is for, individual consumption, stick it in your glass, have a cold drink. And the other is to keep other foods cold. So you would put it in a railway car so that the beef slaughtered in Chicago can make it from Chicago to the East Coast, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both part of the infrastructure and it's a product to be consumed by itself.
Right. Well, that brings me to getting on to development of the mechanical refrigerator. In your book, you talk a lot about the cold chain and inventing the cold chain. And in fact, you broke it up into different stages. Explain for our listeners what you mean by the cold chain.
Well, a cold chain is like a food chain. We all know the food chain. The food is produced in one place that's transported and consumed in another. A cold chain is a kind of food chain that's specifically created for perishable food. So the cold chain begins when you can produce cold somehow. The thing that is being shipped down the cold chain, there has to be some kind of way to preserve it at every step during its transportation. And there has to be something to preserve the food where it's being consumed. And so the cold chain really develops over about a 120-year period from when we can first start to cut ice off lakes and so that we can control the cold until really mechanical refrigeration is reliable enough that it can keep something cold even on a long journey on a railway car, which is really the last part of the cold chain to be filled in. And if you want to know what my book is about, if you want to cover all the different subjects, it's sort of about the development of that cold chain and then sort of its implications now that it's essentially done.
Hmm. Well, when as I read that statistic about 70% of America's food is refrigerated at some point between farm and table, that refers then also to, as you said, the railroad cars,
right.
Refrigerated trucks,
Absolutely.
Warehouses, right? Before.
Yeah, or the warehouses. And it's complicated because there's foods that are highly perishable, like ice cream, that you have to have a whole new cold chain that can keep something frozen for a long period of time. And then there's a food like bananas, and they'll be refrigerated not because they have to be, but if you ship them green from the tropics and you refrigerate them at least a little bit, more of them are going to survive the trip than there would without refrigeration.
Hmm, interesting. Well, so you mentioned bananas. That refrigeration, you mentioned, changed the way that America and the world ate forever.
Yes.
Well, let's get on to the development of this. And why did it take so long for us to figure this out?
So you want to talk about the development of the culture and the stages?
Okay. And,
well, I mean,
right.
we can do this a whole bunch of different ways. I sort of start in the early 19th century when people cut ice. Well, specifically a guy named Frederick Tudor is the pioneer, cuts ice off New England ponds and streams and uses it to, well, mostly to ship ice itself to the tropics, so that people in the Caribbean or even people as far away as India can have cold drinks. And that's the real start of the industry. Nobody had quite figured out how to create cold where cold isn't there at that point in time, just, you know, using and sort of pinpointing where the cold is going to be using what nature provided was sort of the beginning of that industry. That got more efficient over the course of the 19th century, and everybody who was interested in refrigeration all over the world realized that mechanical refrigeration would be a wonderful thing. You know, if we didn't need to rely on winter in the north in order to have cold that we could utilize for our own purposes, then it would be both really useful for humanity and an absolute gold mine. But there are so many different ways to do mechanical refrigeration, and it's very difficult to make it practical. The first mechanical refrigerating machines weigh about 5 tons. Hmm. They're actually used in large part to make ice, as opposed to keep things cold. And that takes, you know, decades to perfect. So the ice industry, cutting stuff off ponds, persists longer than you would imagine, because it's just simply much cheaper than somebody buying one of these great big machines. And so that's, if you want to know why the delay is coming in, it's because making it reliable, making it cost effective takes so long.
I know the first time that when you mentioned the first mechanical or cooling machine or a refrigerator, mm-hmm. Was pretty much a long time before it hit the consumers as, you know, for consumer use. So tell me, who do we credit with that?
The refrigerator is one of those machines that you can't credit anybody individually. There are scientists and inventors working all over the world, and they're working sort of in different directions sometimes. So the kinds of refrigeration that you see in England, for instance, is more than a little different than the kinds of refrigerators that get used in the United States. So the first people are working on this compression system, and they're creating these big 5-ton machines in the 19th century. The first ones pop up in the United States right around the Civil War years, and you have maybe a few hundred of them, mostly in large cities, around the United States right about the turn of the century. The personal mechanical refrigerating machine, the electric household refrigerator, really the first efficient one debuts around 1915, and it grows out of a whole different industrial tradition, because the people who made the big 5-ton machines didn't think that they could mass produce what they did. So the people who are working on the household machines are the same people behind General Motors, for instance. Frigidaire is a division of General Electric. And so they use sort of a similar concept. It's called compression refrigeration. So both the 5-ton machines and the electric household refrigerators work on the compression refrigeration cycle, but they needed a different refrigerant, they needed a different business plan, and that really delays the outset of the home refrigerator, which is something else that everybody was working on inventing for 30 years before it finally hit.
Hmm. So it wasn't an economic battle of somebody tabling this invention while the ice industry continued.
Nobody was saying we have to stop this or our business will be destroyed.
Right.
It was a very difficult machine to perfect, and it was a difficult machine to find a market for, because usually with a new invention, it's going to come in, like the computer, it's going to come in its first iteration as being really expensive. So the first people who bought electric household refrigerators were the rich. And it doesn't, I even know this, this is in the book, the majority of Americans do not have a household electric household refrigerator until World War II.
Wow. Well, you know, it's interesting because, as I mentioned, you wrote an article, an excerpt from the book, basically, for The Atlantic, and why are Americans' refrigerators so big? So everyone gets these refrigerators, but then it's really not, you know, I don't think it's it's not American wanting, oh, bigger is better. Yes, bigger is better in many ways for Americans, but, you know, it was all about the growth and the sprawl of populations in suburban areas. I mean, shopping, you know, they didn't have the markets, so supermarkets came along. You had to shop a little more efficiently, right, like once a week, so... You know, putting them in a big putting all your food in a big refrigerator, I guess, was the way to keep it.
It's a cultural thing,
yeah.
And I think it's not exclusively the fault of the people who sell refrigerators, but they will market to you, starting in World War II, that one of the reasons you should get rid of your old refrigerator and get a new one is because the new ones are bigger and they have more volume, yet they take up the same amount of space.
Hmm.
And refrigerators last a really long time. Speaking of antique shows, you can still find some of the early, late 1920s refrigerators running if somebody who owns them really knows their way around a refrigerator. And a 20s refrigerator and a refrigerator from today do the same thing. They keep food cold, and they can keep food cold very effectively. And so the people need to convince you that your old refrigerator is obsolete and you need to buy a new one. And I've seen so many of the ads from the 40s and 50s. Marketing is one. This kind of marketing towards size, is really the best pitch they have.
Hmm.
Even though your old refrigerator works fine and you'll probably just move it to the basement and keep sodas down there, they're fine with that. They just want you to buy a new one.
Of course, maybe not as energy efficient as today's refrigerators, right?
That's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
Which is one of the downsides of this whole refrigerator craze. I mean, it's not the best thing for our environment.
You know, it's complicated. I certainly agree with you that one should not have a refrigerator and not worry about, let's put this a little differently, that one should worry about the energy efficiency of your refrigerator. But refrigeration keeps things from spoiling. And having food that's produced and spoiling is just as harmful to the environment as refrigerating food, keeping it fresh. I think you can argue that it can be much worse. If we got rid of all of our refrigerators tomorrow, all the stuff that would rot in the fields would have a much worse effect on the food that's decaying, creating the same kind of greenhouse gases that the energy used to run your refrigerator creates, and that would be an equal problem. I think the problem is not that food miles are an irrelevant concept, but only they need to be balanced off other things.
All right. That is a very good point. And it brings me back to the point where you mentioned that it changed the way that America and the world ate forever, and you just mentioned food from, you know, that's harvested can be kept longer.
Right.
Also, we can eat food from further away and more exotic foods. And
right. I mean, there are two ways to get food out of season. One is you take some stuff that's grown in your area and you refrigerate it so that it'll be available in winter when it wouldn't be coming up ordinarily. Or during winter, thanks to refrigeration, we can get all of our fresh fruits and vegetables from California or Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And refrigeration makes both of those things happen, and the people who first benefited from that found that to be absolutely amazing, and then it sort of fades into the background very quickly.
All right. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the taste and also about frozen food when we come back. We're going to take a short break, so when we come back, let's talk about that.
You are listening to 4 of 7 by Jack Inslee on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Today's program is brought to you by Regional Access. Regional Access is a regional distributor committed to creating sustainable economies throughout the Northeast. This community-oriented company was built on a vision of providing ecologically responsible and ethically produced food to area consumers. During a typical week at the Regional Access warehouse, they help move thousands of pounds of natural and grass-fed meat, gallons of farm-fresh dairy, and tons of organic and specialty foods from producer to market. Having been in the distribution business for almost 25 years, Regional Access's experience and knowledge make them uniquely equipped to build out their region's food web. Up in the Finger Lakes, Regional Access will continue to champion the region's bounty and work toward a sustainable food system for the entire Northeast. For more information, visit regionalaccess.net.
Hi, welcome back. I'm talking with Dr. Jonathan Rees from Colorado State University at Pueblo, who's published a book, written a book called Refrigeration Nation. The whole title is Refrigeration Nation, A History of Ice, Appliances, and Enterprise in America. And Jonathan, interesting because we, you know, a lot of talk now is about going sustainably local, being, you know, shopping locally. But still, people forget food needs to be refrigerated, even if you are accessing it from a local farm. Let's say, you know, you can't walk to the farm. So, you know, refrigeration is still something that's needed, even though some people eschew the, you know, any kind of mechanical processing of the food. But it does have to be kept cold. You said refrigeration has changed the way that we eat forever. I mean, certainly we have a much more varied diet than we did before. Tell me a little bit about what, as far as the economics and the enterprise in America, how refrigeration has affected that.
Well, the refrigeration industry is really far-reaching. There are whole technologies, separate technologies, for keeping food fresh all along the cold chain from the point of production to the point of consumption. And so what I do in the book is try to at least quickly profile a few of those businesses and a few of those aspects of the industry. In terms of the economics, it's a combination of making food more expensive and making it cheaper. It costs more to get something from far away to market, so sometimes the prices are higher. But at the same time, if more food is on the market because it didn't spoil, that'll also drive prices lower.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the great, just to give you a for instance, one of the chapters I'm most proud of, because I don't think any other historian has ever touched it, I do a whole chapter on the cold storage industry. And it's one of the great controversies of the progressive era that seems to have been completely forgotten. People said, oh no, cold storage food is going to be terrible. And it might be unhealthy, and cold storage is a way to manipulate the market because they can hold something like apples off the market and create these false scarcities, when really the people who investigated it saw what would happen is that they would hold some of the food off the market and they'll try to even out the cycle so that the price of an apple is about the same when it's in season and when it's out of season. And gradually Americans came to accept, actually it's a little more than gradually, World War I, when they were worried about food shortages, is about the time when Americans decided that maybe the slight taste sacrifice of a cold storage apple or a cold storage egg is worth it in order to be able to have it when they're not in season or when they're not in regular supply.
Well, that is interesting, bringing it back to taste. And you mentioned that, of course, everything tastes better fresh than being held.
Right.
But it's, you know, what would we do if we couldn't hold it? You know, and
I think Americans are willing to sacrifice taste for access.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. What about the frozen industry? I mean, we had refrigeration. So did freezing? You mentioned frozen items, making ice, that came about at the same time. Obviously, one portion could be colder than another of the refrigerator.
It's a little more complicated than that. The early ice industry tried doing things like shipping apples to India along with the ice, and they didn't turn out so well. Even meat, the meat can't touch ice or it's going to turn black. the inside the railroad cars, they have to be physically separated. So ice is first used just as ice for the most part, whether in consumption or in transportation. Frozen food is really a whole different industry. We all know the primary person behind that is Clarence Birdseye, who invented the effective flash freezing technology in the late 1920s. And then there had to be a whole different infrastructure created to get frozen food into the supermarket. And that didn't really come in until after World War II.
But the early refrigerators, did early refrigerators always contain a freezing compartment as well?
That's a really good question. Early refrigerators are coldest near the cold-producing apparatus. And so what happens is there'll just be a little teeny part of the refrigerator that's frozen cold. And you could get a little plastic or metal ice tray, put some water in, and voila, you would have your own ice cubes. But it wasn't a freezer section. The separate freezer section is something that debuts after World War II when there's frozen food in order to keep in it.
So we have these huge, actually even freezer drawers,
right,
separate from our refrigerators. I mean, that's, the world is changing in those appliance modes, but we have definitely become very dependent on our refrigerators. Not such a bad thing. But you mentioned at one part that the modern housewife, something to the effect that the modern housewife comes back from her weekly grocery shopping and unloads all the groceries in the refrigerator and then closes the door. And as she does, she closes the door on a lot of past techniques of food preservation. But it's interesting. You mentioned that earlier, right? The pickling and drying and canning. But now it seems that things have sort of come full circle, and people are, there, a lot of the younger generations are now really embracing some of those older techniques.
I agree. The whole local food movement, the artisanal food movement, is sort of a rebellion against the industrialized food that refrigeration makes possible.
Well, I mean, I grew up in an era where all of a sudden the big home freezers, just a big huge freezer, was new and a novelty, and one would have one of these in the garage or in the basement, and then the delivery man would come and stock it every so often, you know, and get a side of beef a quarter of a beef or a side of a pig and all these frozen vegetables. Oh, I grew up learning to hate the taste of frozen foods. There is a difference between frozen foods and refrigerated foods, but obviously it's in the process, I would imagine.
Yeah, there is. You can make the case that people in New York City still don't know how good a California orange can be, because when it gets there, it's not the same orange. I think a lot of people just sort of take refrigeration for granted and assume that perishable food that they have in New York is not going to be the same as they would have in California. But the closer you are to the point of production, there's no question the better it's going to taste. And it's not so much that I take a position on this, but what I want people who read the book to understand is that there is this infrastructure that most people have forgotten about, so that they can appreciate, is the best word I can think of, all the effort and all the history that it's taken to get food from California to their table.
Yeah, I think what people also, you talk about this infrastructure, you know, a lot. It's obviously one of the stages of in the cold chain. It's part of the cold chain, but we mentioned warehouses earlier, but not even just warehouses. You know, I said the refrigerated trucks, but the display cases in the supermarkets.
Right.
And supermarkets alone are a whole invention that would not have existed without refrigeration, actually.
The first frozen food display cases in grocery stores didn't have lids on them. So what would happen is the boxes on the top would melt slightly. And that really hurt the reputation of frozen foods early on. One of the things they managed to do is realize the problem and bring down the cost of frozen display cases for grocery stores, and that's one of the things that made the mass consumption of frozen food possible. because people will say, oh, maybe it's not that bad. It wasn't as bad as it was when it started.
Hmm. Yeah, indeed. Well, there's always room for improvement. And if bigger is better in refrigerator mode, I mean, I don't know if that's the route we have to necessarily take, but it's not bad. It's not bad to unload all your groceries and have space on the shelf rather than cramming things, getting lost in the back of the refrigerator that have been there for God knows how long, right?
One of the themes of the book, one of the reasons it took me so long to write it, is about three-quarters of the way in, I realized I had to make some sort of effort at being comparative. And so it's also worth appreciating that a lot of other countries don't go shopping only once a week. That in France or Italy, the refrigerators are much smaller, and they're not as willing to make sacrifices for taste for the sake of convenience. And that it's sort of the sub-theme of the book is that, you know, Americans refrigeration crazy are a little refrigeration crazy, and that's one of the things that make us unique.
Yes, indeed. Living in the city, of course, one can go shopping every day if you're close to food markets and you live in one of these, as I said earlier at the top of the show, sprawling suburban areas where they're not food deserts. Because they do have cars and access to large supermarkets, but not someplace where you could walk to get your food, and every day might be a bit of a chore to get there. But indeed, it's something that America has embraced, and then some. Well, Jonathan, I have found the book really fascinating on more than one level, more than just the cold level. And I thank you so much for sharing your information with me today on A Taste of the Past, and look forward to more interesting information coming out from you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I want to remind everyone, you've been listening to A Taste of the Past on heritageradionetwork.org, and I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.